Hello and welcome to The Right Idea, where we discuss the people, policy, and politics that drive Texas. I'm your host, Brian Phillips. I'm the Chief Communications Officer at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Derek Cohen. He is the Vice President of Research here at TPPF. And as we always like to start off the show, hot take, Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson, let's get into the story real quick. Willie Nelson's beloved 4th of July picnic, which should be right here in Texas, always right here, even in Central Texas, where he is most beloved, this year is going to be in Philadelphia / New Jersey-ish. Hot take.
Well, hot take on that is I think that the Nelson camp probably just couldn't decide whether they wanted mediocre pizza or mediocre sandwiches and had to split the difference.
Man, that's good. I like that. That's a good hot take. Apparently, according to, you know, because the Austin American Statesman has to apologize for everything, apparently they did the history of the picnic, and this is not only not the first time that it has not happened in Texas, but it's not the first time it has happened in New Jersey.
Really?
Well, the first one apparently was back in 1972, so it's been a long time, but I just think it's sacrilegious that Willie Nelson picnic, who's such a Texas icon, would even be, you know, anywhere north of the Red River, much less somewhere like Philadelphia.
Yeah, you know, there's no accounting for taste, as they say, but you know, maybe it's with Casey Musgraves releasing that new album that you know, just trying to get the publicity spread about, as opposed to just doing the they usually have that out at Coda, don't they?
Yeah, they've had it at Coda before. You know, you mentioned the album. Willie Nelson does have a new album, so he's on a tour.
He has a new album as well?
Yeah, I mean, Willie Nelson's still doing it. He's absolutely still doing
it. My goodness.
All right, so we'll get to the shameless plug real quick. Of course, we have our newsletter that comes out every Thursday. It's got some exclusive information. It's a little composite of everything TPPF's working on, as well as kind of news of the day, and we always have some fun stuff about Texas. It's called The Post, and you can sign up for it at texaspolicy.com/thepost. Okay, let's get to why we're all here. We are super excited to have David Bahnsen with us today. He's the founder and managing partner, chief investment officer at the Bahnsen Group, a national private wealth management firm. He spent 8 years as a managing director at Morgan Stanley and 6 years as vice president at UBS, and he's consistently named one of the top financial advisors in America. David, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're a fellow podcaster, which is awesome. You have a very successful podcast called The Capital Record.
I do. It's incubated over at National Review, Capital Record, kind of a play on the old record label name, but talking, of course, about capital markets, my defense of capitalism.
Well, the one thing I really like about the podcast is that you take a lot of these very esoteric and very complicated issues, particularly in the world of finance and investing and those kinds of things, and make it very relatable to folks. We try to do that with policy, but we end up just having bad hot takes and bad jokes, and I guess somehow that makes us popular too. But you also have a book that just came out in February, which is great, just last month. It's called Full Time Work and the Meaning of Life. Which, I mean, if you're going to tell us what the meaning of life is, then that's a must read.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty important thing to figure out in one's life, what the meaning of it is. And that is indeed my hot take, that work is the meaning of life. Work is what God made us for. And this idea in America that we would be going towards a more European understanding of work, I think, is an unmitigated disaster. Mm. And that the American ethos is one rooted in a high regard of work. And we're getting away from that to our own peril.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say, you know, there's a lot of books about, well, you know, there's a lot of books about why you shouldn't work, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's the whole Nancy Pelosi thing. We should be, you know, and subsidizing people and whatever they want to do. If they want to sell roses on the side of the road, that's fine. But there's other people that that say, you know, well, we should get back to work, but there should be a work-life balance. And, you know, you get a lot of that. How is your book different, and what road does it take?
Well, I don't believe in a work-life balance. I don't believe that makes any sense. I believe if what simply is meant is do not work 24 hours a day, nobody works 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And are there moments in one's work life which they need to leave the office early to go to a kids' school event? Of course. Are there times where you're not going to be home for dinner with your family because you got to work late for a project? Of course. And the idea that we need to codify into the societal structures, yoga time and nap time and adult coloring book time.
Oh, God.
This isn't about work-life balance. It's infantilizing grown adults.
Yeah.
And it is primarily a millennial construct that came about, I think, because they were raised to resent work. Mm-hmm. Because I think the mantra of baby boomers is the first generation ever that had their eyes on something called retirement that was, prior to that, a total mystery and foreign concept in world history, other than the retirement plan to die. the a notion that one would have the mortality and the prosperity to be able to have a 25-year vacation at the end of their life never existed.
Never thought of it that way, but yeah,
but
sure.
I think that really is what kind of the boomers introduced. Now, of course, what they did really well was work hard.
Yeah.
They produced more goods and services than any generation in human history. But they left a sort of mentality that work was something you do to not have to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And the millennials just fast-forwarded the same concept a few decades ahead of them and said, okay, well, we agree with you, and we're going to start feeling that way right out the gate. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, introduced ideas like work-life balance. I think work is very important and is a big part of our life, and so I don't look to balance it with my life. Mm-hmm. I think marriage is very important. I don't look to balance it with my life. By the way, no one goes home and says to their spouse, honey, I can't talk right now. I'm doing marriage life balance. The only thing
we're talking about. Or they never say it twice, at least.
Not a second time. That's right. The only thing that we talk about with this blank life balance is work. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't come from a desire to work less and have better priorities and more family time. It comes from a general downward pressure on the positivity that we discuss work with. Ultimately, this is a problem for those in faith circles. It's a problem for those in red states, a problem for those in blue states. It's become a very societal issue. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that a lot of the people most writing about how bad work is actually hate their work. And that to me is the hypocrisy of the moment. People who don't practice what they preach. Mm-hmm. One of the things inspired me to write this book was an article I'd read in The Atlantic. And The Atlantic is oftentimes very good
writing.
So you're
the one conservative who reads that. Yeah, okay.
No, there's a lot of conservatives that read it. Not a lot of conservatives that agree with much they read there. Yeah. But there's often very good writing, but usually a very leftist point of view.
Keep your enemy closer kind of thing?
Well, no, but I wouldn't even say that. I know what you mean, though. But I think culturally, sometimes they'll address certain issues that can be very thoughtful. Mm. But someone who has a job that's very, very well-paying, is very socioeconomically prestigious, they have kind of, you know, a lot of people complimenting them, a high notoriety, like in a writer at The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And they writes an article about how bad work is. I think there's something extremely elitist about it. The person who wrote that article does not hate their job.
Derek is a fan of the book, and so he's going to give you his very critical review here right now and live on the show.
Actually, no. I mean, I was going to say fan of the book indeed, but one of the things I'd like to hear you unpack a little better, specifically on the work-life balance, because you've gone into it on previous appearances as well as having gone into it well within the book, is that you actually describe work as part of life. I mean, I cannot express enough how I appreciate the way you delineate that work-life balance as a concept versus work and life, mm-hmm. you know, as part of an integral unit is important. But you support a lot of that within the book with a discussion of faith.
Yes.
Could you unpack that for us, please?
Yeah, I mean, the essence of the book is my belief that God made us for the purpose of work. And where I got that from was the direct pages of scripture where God said so. And so I took...
Huge if true.
Is it cited in the book?
It is. There's even footnotes.
I see what you did there.
To the extent the idea that we are made in the image of God and God himself was a worker and a creator and a producer and innovator, and he asked us to do the same with alongside him. But the difference is he could create out of nothing and we can't. So we create out of the raw materials of the world. And when we talk about cultivating the earth, we talk about being fruitful, multiplying, filling the earth, ruling over the animal kingdom, ruling over the kind of natural forces. The time it was a garden, we ended up building cities, we built civilizations. Every single thing I just said, the verb is work. Mm. All of it comes down to some sort of productive activity that can be summarized in a four-letter word, work. I think that this is what God made us for. As a man of faith and people who are familiar with the Christian doctrine of original sin, I think God made work before he made sin. He did not make work because of sin. And I believe that we need to restore that productive activity because teleologically, meaning the purpose we have in life, we can't be happy not living according to that purpose. Right now, the modern progressive ethos, it was funny, Marx wrote about this. Some people quote it sometimes not knowing it's Marx. And I don't think they would quote it if they knew. This idea of fishing in the morning and writing poetry in the afternoon and this sort of life of quiet recreation. You know, this was Marx's exact language, that there was some sort of evil in work that pitted us as a proletariat against nature. Marx was arguing from bad theology. It wasn't bad politics. Mm-hmm. It was a bad philosophy, a bad framework in which he understood the world. My framework is that there's a lot of joy in work and that we produce goods and services that meet the needs of humanity. And in so doing, we have our needs met, and we only get our needs met by meeting the needs of others. And it creates virtuous cycles. It's a wonderful idea.
You use work and purpose together a lot, and I think you were almost on your way there. Is that where you then take the next lead to, and that's how you connect work and purpose?
Yes. Now, of course, I do not mean that the only purpose one would have in life is the compensation they get from work. But the activity that one has out of their productive labors is the purpose of their life. Mm-hmm. And if someone could say, no, my purpose is to raise good kids. And I go, oh, that sounds really good. Good. Mm-hmm. I want you to raise good kids. What are you raising them for? Now, your answer is either I'm raising them so they'll have productive labor, mm-hmm. or I'm raising them so they'll raise productive kids, mm-hmm. or good kids that then are going to raise more kids.
Someone else to mow the lawn.
Is that that's even pretty hard these days. And with minimum wage, I don't think you're going to be able to afford to pay your own kid to mow the lawn anymore.
That's what the roof is for.
We are getting all of this wrong, and I think we're getting it wrong because we don't understand Genesis chapter 1, what God made us for to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And something you triggered in one of your earlier answers made me think about this in a different way, is that there's kind of a mantra. I know we've moved on to Gen Z and evaluating them and everything, but the millennials, you know, there was a mantra when millennials were coming up, retire by 30, right? Like everybody wanted to invent the next Facebook or invent the next, iPhone or something like that, and then make a bunch of money and retire by 30. And I think, as part of that latter end of Gen X, or maybe certainly baby boomers, maybe interpreted that more cynically than they should have, right? Which is not that millennials, the charitable interpretation would be that not that millennials were saying, well, I want to make all this money so that I can live this life of leisure after 30, but that I can then go on and do purposeful things with this new advantage that I have with money and time and those kinds of stuff. Do you think that's a fair charitable reading of what
Well, maybe what they meant, but I think it is an awful way for them to think. And so it may be more charitable, but I want to be clear what I mean by awful. If you are a person who has the skillfulness to create something that has now enabled you to not have to work anymore at age 30. You have a certain talent, an entrepreneurial gift, a risk-taking acumen, perhaps technological or programmatic skill set. Mm-hmm. The last thing I want in the world is for you to be off the chessboard, to say, okay, I've now made so much money, I no longer have to do the thing I'm making money, I can now do these other things. And by the way, it's so funny. People go, I want to invent the next Facebook so I don't have to work anymore. You might want to tell that to the guy who invented Facebook. Right? And this is one of my favorite stories. It's a true story. It was in Fortune magazine, the early 1990s. It might have been the late 80s. It was before Windows 95. Microsoft was huge, and Bill Gates was very wealthy, but you're not even close to the multi-billionaire status he ended up getting to. And Fortune was interviewing him. He was single at the time. And they said, Mr. Gates, what's the deal? You're worth $100 million. And you're known for sleeping in the office, pizza boxes laying around, work all the time. If I was worth $100 million, I'd never work another day in my life. And Gates looked up at him and said, that's why you'll never be worth $100 million. There's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy in it. The most entrepreneurially gifted people in our society are never motivated by an exit.
Right.
They're motivated by the productive activity that itself bears fruit. Yes, they can then take the fruit and go on to do other things. Mm-hmm. But those other things are not going to be, I've been so good at inventing Google that now I'm going to go build an orphanage.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you're any good at building an orphanage. I know you're good at inventing Google.
And Derek, there's an Austinite here who's worth several hundred billion dollars, who's, building a gigafactory and the next thing and the next thing.
Montessori school on the way?
And Montessori school, yes. Here we go, school choice advocate.
But one of the things I wanted to add, though, because I in the spirit of, again, since you couch much of this book in faith principles, in the spirit of removing the moat from our own eye, I'd like to talk about your treatise and the new right, or the new right du jour, I think we can say. And I find it very interesting because your treatise on work makes an awful lot of sense to me. But we generally see from the folks that I would consider on the new right a fundamental rejection of that. Theirs almost comes from, and I don't mean to put words in their mouth, but I think that they've said enough words out of their mouth that is largely a fair take.
If you mean by words out of their mouth, they're tweets.
Yeah. Okay. yes, that's very true. When I say new rights, I mean, the folks who diagnose themselves as, basically pro-life socialists now.
Yeah.
Is that their theory on work and on value is essentially Marxist. It comes from the labor theory of value, where they say that whatever the productivity of one's the productivity value of one's product is, has to do with the work put in. And then, you know, if you accept that as a reality, that essentially gives you leave to say, well, you know, we just need two more branches of the military, the national hole digging branch and then the national hole filling in branch. Yeah. So how do you see kind of that philosophy on work and on labor? How do you see that fitting in with the right, and point out the pain points that we have between that and in your treatise, which I fundamentally find superior to that?
Yeah. So thanks for asking that, because I appreciate any time I get to criticize the new right in love and deep and sincere concern. This is an example where the application is wrong because the fundamental principles are wrong. And the right has known this with the left for a long time. We believe there was dignity in work, not class struggle. We believe that an entrepreneur or a capitalist facilitated the efforts of a proletariat and added value to commercial society, not that the proletariat was in arms race against the capitalist, as Marx believed. So we had a fundamentally different belief about history. And ultimately, my view is that a market economy is to be advocated because the human person is to work, and a market economy facilitates the things that generate better work, better productive activity, more division of labor, more mutual cooperation, more free exchange, more price discovery, more economic calculation, more specialization. Whenever someone says, look, that's great that you love your job, David, you're a wealthy guy, you have a white collar job, but you know, I have to do this and I don't like doing it, I always say, on a micro level, let's talk and see if you really have to do this, or what a path to doing something else you might like better may be. But on a macro level, there's only one thing you should be advocating in a market economy, is greater freedom in the marketplace, because that freedom in the marketplace is what has facilitated so much more division of labor and specialization. People are largely able to pursue where their skills lie, and to a lesser degree where their passions lie, and ultimately aspire to where their skills and their passions marry one another. They're able to do that now because of the beauty of a market economy. What they were not able to do in a more feudal or centrally planned economy was get out of a factory or get out of the family farm. I want that kind of choice and labor dynamism that only a classically oriented free market economy can provide.
And so does your treatise then entertain a discussion on, you mentioned labor freedom, and you know, I don't want to beat a libertarian hobby horse without bringing up occupational licensing, access to job training, things like that. How does that contemplate?
Again, I mean, these things become more my market-oriented principles that I believe, before we look at any state intervention, we have to presuppose it comes at a cost. Mm-hmm. And that does not mean all state interventions are not worth the cost. It just means we at least acknowledge it and dissect it and analyze it. And then when it comes to the incredible public service being provided by state mandate license requirements of people who braid hair, then we would all agree that we cannot afford to live in a society that doesn't regulate hair braiding.
Yeah, or eyebrow threading.
No, I mean, I can't even imagine. But what you're doing is impeding work. And I would add, by the way, that's one that we can be sarcastic about, because almost everyone agrees with us. But then things like minimum wage laws, almost everyone disagrees with us. Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely no question that minimum wage laws have proved to be a war on teenage employment, mm-hmm. a war on part-time employment. and ultimately driven incentives to create kiosks and take people out of Carl's Jr. and McDonald's. You start taking people out of Carl's Jr. and McDonald's, now it's personal for me.
Yeah. I was about to say, if we can steal a line from our friend and former colleague Vance Ginn, it's that the real minimum wage is zero.
I want to shift gears. I'm not going to change gears. I want to shift gears a little bit in a second, but I am curious on that point on minimum wage. We poll that all the time, and we always get 60-70% of people that say the minimum wage should be $15 an hour, or more, $20 an hour. Are we just losing the messaging war on that, or we're not the concept messaging.
It's not messaging.
Or just the concept that that it destroys these entry level jobs that then create the patterns and the habits that good people or that people will learn to then become more productive citizens.
Well, I think what we're doing is we're losing the war of ideas. First you win the argument, then you win the election. And we are too focused on winning the election and not focused enough on winning the argument. And Vance's point about the real wage is $0 is, of course, an argument he Milton Friedman articulated years ago. Mm-hmm. But it's a very important one because it requires a certain economic foundation, a certain economic understanding. And when you and it really, in a lot of ways, it just gets down to the basic old broken window fallacy that Hazlitt popularized from Friedrich Bastiat. Visibly, I see someone making $7 an hour and want them to make 15. And so I can say visibly, it's a good thing that they just got their wage doubled. Mm-hmm. But invisibly, what I don't see is the person not getting hired, who's now getting zero, who could have got 7 or 8. Now, everyone can look and just say, this is ridiculous. The owner makes so much money, they could easily pay more. And what about a living wage? And this is a big problem. You said 15, and I was deeply offended when you said it. 15 is not a living wage. Well, okay, 20. 20 is not a living wage.
Right.
And by the way, where is it? Let's say someone goes, owner, you can get by on whatever that amounts to, mm-hmm. 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year in certain part of the country. I go, okay, well, come to Manhattan. I need a living wage in Midtown Manhattan. Well, I don't think you're going to get it there. So is the minimum wage $100 an hour? I mean, there isn't a definable living wage. Mm-hmm. But the point of it is that the person who sets the wage is first the producer and second the consumer. And they come to mutual cooperation about what the wage ought to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that works well with every single other thing in society. We come together. And it's called price discovery. And we say, I will buy every day of my life. It's on an app now instead of cash in pocket. But I have $4.75 and I want a coffee. And I agree that I want the coffee more than I want $4.75. And every worker has a wage at which they say, my time is worth this. My skills are worth this. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's never been about living wage. These are low skill jobs that we desperately want teenagers to do so they don't grow up to be spoiled brats.
Exactly. All right. So shifting gears here a little bit, I want to get into the age old question of, I don't know if it's work versus family or family and work or what have you. Of course, through the generations, I mean, like I said, I'm at the tail end of the Generation X, but then getting to millennials, you see this where people are delaying mm-hmm. families. And what they're telling you is, well, I want to focus on work or I want to mm-hmm. focus on my career. A lot of folks would look at that and say, well, a lot of the reason, that is because even when you have married couples, they both have to work because of various, housing costs mm-hmm. and all kinds of other changes over the last couple of decades. But I want to get into that. What do you think, if you took that approach, if you took, your approach to this, to work and purpose and all of that, how does that fit into family formation? And what trends would you see as a result? Let's say everybody adopted that approach. Would you see any kind of movement in terms of trends of people going back to having families, starting families in their mid-20s, late-20s, mm-hmm. more than they would? How do you think that would fit together?
No, I think what I'm suggesting is the most pro-family policy idea out there, pro-family mentality out there. People who are employable are marryable. People who are marryable are employable. Someone who's unemployable, I mean, we can sit here and play games if we want. We can lie about it. And we don't have any women on the set with us, but you tell me, you think a lot of women out there are interested in men that are totally unhirable? Is that a hot ticket? I don't think so. Everyone knows this. We're just lying to ourselves. Mm-hmm. But also it's a character trait. It's a responsibility. It's the ability to kind of get around in public and know how to be. mm-hmm. not drool on yourself.
Well, I would go further than just to say marryable. I mean, the commitment and the time and all of that that it takes to then, you know, to start a family and raise a family versus the hours in the day that you have to spend on work. I think, like, is that conflict still there?
I think what's interesting is that the tension you're describing is the polar opposite of the reality of what's happening now. The people who are waiting longer to get married because they can't find a spouse are not the people that are out thriving in a career.
Okay.
They are the people that are playing video games and smoking
pot.
Great
point. Yeah, great point.
So they are both sacrificing work and family. They're not sacrificing family for the sake of work.
Right.
Now, to the degree, certainly like an area where I live, like New York, and I'm sure it's true in Austin and other like kind of more metropolitan mm-hmm. and cosmopolitan markets, there are people that are so focused on the success of their career that they're staying single longer. But I would argue that that is not a necessary tension. It's a chosen tension. Mm. I believe fervently that the greatest thing for one's marriage they can do is build their careers together. Mm-hmm. I find it very odd when someone says, okay, I've made it. I'm now financially successful. And now I want to go find a spouse. And I go, you think you're going to have the same level of trust and togetherness mm-hmm. that you would have had if you built those things together? Mm. There's nothing that reinforces a marital commitment like someone who loves you when you're poor. love you when you're already rich, it's much less impressive.
Not a whole lot of 18-year-old prenups.
Yeah, not too much.
Derek, what marriage questions do you have for David?
Yeah. Well, specifically on ESG. No. This conversation has been very good, and I think that this particular take on work is something that has largely been absent. From the discussion so far, not because its constituent elements haven't been included, but they haven't necessarily been tied together in a way. To your point about that, have been in a way that's been publicly saleable, but we have not yet won that argument.
Yeah.
And I think that should be the next project for the right. And by that, I mean the actual right, the mm-hmm. conservative right, versus worrying about, oh, we just need a right-wing labor unions.
Yeah.
So we only have about 10 minutes left or so, and I want to get to the ESG discussion, because that's actually why we brought you, or that why you're here in the building, and we snagged you and wanted to talk about your book and all that. But I do want to get to the ESG thing, because you're in an event today, and folks can go watch that discussion. It's fantastic with Representative Crenshaw and former Attorney General from Kentucky was there, mm-hmm. who ran for governor, I think, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Or Lieutenant Governor.
Yep. Yeah, and came this close. Anyway, so it was a great discussion. Jason Isaac, of course, was there. So go and watch that. But I do want to talk about ESG for a second, because you gave a definition of ESG, or at least an explanation of kind of that general question of, for our audience, like explaining really what the essence of ESG really is.
Yeah, I mean, my view is that historically it started off as a rather significantly radical environmental movement. The S and the G was an afterthought, and it didn't start off as a policy. It didn't start off out of the political class, and it didn't even start off as a financial product. It was more of a mentality and a movement wanted to impose onto certain elements of culture considerations that were largely, let's just call it, for lack of a better word, kind of the tree-hugging mm-hmm. type. It was very anti-fossil fuel. It was very anti-pollution and whatnot. And there could have been some good intentions, and maybe even here and there a few good people. But it was largely, right. I think, a not super intellectualized impulse that was more environmentally oriented.
And as someone who manages billions of dollars, I need to mention that, because David's kind of got a bird's eye view from all this. Did that give you pause at first, or did you just think, oh, this is just a bunch of hippies who have some money now, and now they're, you know, pushing their way into finance?
Well, I think that I didn't take seriously that it could ever really become a significant movement, because when you peeled back the onion, it was very hard to understand what it really stood for, what mm-hmm. it was about. And I think what happened is that their timing was utterly perfect. Just the ability to start pressing forward a cultural movement in a moment that then tech and other sectors that were largely less carbon intensive, while the oil and gas sector was deleveraging and going through, at the time, a kind of OPEC fracking mm-hmm. battle. And it was just a market cycle in which tech was doing well and energy was doing poorly. Mm-hmm. And it enabled Wall Street to do what it does best, which was market and asset gather off of a concept that was imminently sellable. Mm-hmm. But it was all rooted in a really basic and, quite frankly, obvious financial lie, which was you're going to get a better return and you're going to have, you're going to be saving the planet while you're doing it. You're not going to have to give anything up. And it enabled
magic.
What Americans love more than anything else. And a lot of us learned this throughout a number of different moments in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. People love to feel good about themselves without any sacrifice, mm-hmm. without any pain. They don't want to go to war. They don't want to go canvas. They don't want to go volunteer. They don't want to go, you know, give up a job and do something real meaningful that is going to involve public sacrifice. But they don't mind posting something on Instagram. They do that pretty well. And ESG was an incredible opportunity for Phariseeism. Mm-hmm. You don't have to lift a finger, but you can tell everyone you're saving the planet. That's what it was. And Wall Street brought in about $3 trillion early on doing it.
I've got a couple more on ESG. Did you have...
Specifically on the ESG side, I would add, or I would ask, is ESG obviously has been something that seems to have, you know, a bunch of you said came a confluence of perfect factors has escaped the lab. Mm-hmm. How my question to you, and having the specific vantage point that you have, how did you see it then start to co-opt? Obviously, right now, you know, we're recording this at the end of March 2024. The incident of October 7th, not terribly long ago, but we've seen the BDS movement as almost an vanguard of, I would say, contemporary ESG. You know, starting decades ago. Do you see that, like, ESG in and of itself has been, I would say, adopted by the entire left-wing project, or has it been deployed by it purposefully?
Well, the kind of chicken or egg of this is hard to identify. It almost doesn't matter what came first, because at some point there was no question that it was a perfectly integratable opportunity to bring the ESG mentality and some of the strategies into the totality of the left-wing project. And what they did is married it to corporate America. Mm. And so there is a significant amount of kind of green mailing that goes on. What does Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren hate more than dirty fossil fuel?
Getting their third house foreclosed on.
Profits.
That's what I meant to say.
Rich so people. if you're a Fortune 100 company and you're out there making a whole bunch of money, and Bernie and Liz Warren are going to come after you, and they don't like your stock options, and they don't like your CEO pay, and they don't like your all the white people on your board and all this stuff. And you go, okay, look, leave us alone, but then we're going to put an ESG sticker on, and we're going to measure how little of our carbon we're burning and all this kind of stuff. It was blackmail. Mm-hmm. And I think that ESG and then later DEI became a way for Fortune 100 companies. Everyone goes, I can't believe it. Corporate America went woke. And I said, you really believe that? You think these people care about anything more than profits? They don't.
So I'm curious if, and we don't have to do the chicken or the egg, but there definitely is a tension there between, you know, these funds that are trying to, you know, virtue signal through their ESG. The tension is that a lot of, as you mentioned, the ESG funds didn't perform or don't perform, or they don't actually make any money. I mean, maybe that's too broad of a statement to say they don't make any money, but there's definitely a fiduciary responsibility by these money managers to actually make money for their clients. And so if you lay ESG on top of that, which is more of an activist fueled investing versus the pure fiduciary fueled investing, which is we're going to do whatever we need to do to make money. Are they trying intentionally to destroy like the oil companies and all of that? Or is it just a byproduct and they don't, what they're saying is we don't really care if you make money as long as you're doing the right thing.
Well, see, I think you have to distinguish between different levels of activism. And so I hate to get into the nuance here, but you guys are pretty smart and the listeners are
pretty
smart.
A bunch of nerds listen to this podcast.
Let's do this. Let's nerd out. What if someone says it's an ESG fund? It means we own the whole S&P 500, which includes Exxon and Chevron. But when we say it's an ESG S&P 500, it means we're going to make the shares be voted a certain way. We're going to vote for directors that are more in line with our principles. So they own everything. But it's passive, it's indexed, and yet they want the ESG to come from kind of being involved in a voting mentality. That's mm-hmm. one form. That's categorically different than saying we're a manager and we're only going to buy companies that meet our criteria: solar energy, wind. So those, ESG branded S&P 500 can make money when the whole stock market goes up. They're not anti-making money, but they're charging a few more fees and putting a virtue signaling brand on it. But you still own Exxon. Now, let's say you and I were radical greenies and we wanted to move the needle, and Exxon is emitting a ton of carbon and Facebook isn't, and I want to change the world. What am I going to impact the world with more by owning and impacting and influencing and engaging? Exxon or Facebook? Engaging with a company that's already doing what I want them to do and already not doing what I don't want them to do? Or do I want to go on Exxon to kind of get them to change their behavior? So the irony of it is, it really sort of proves my pharisaical virtue signaling argument. I would be more afraid if they were going out and buying the companies that I like, that they don't like, and trying to influence the companies. They're not doing that. It's pure branding and marketing, saying, hey, you people out there, you want to save the environment too. We want to save the environment. Come buy more Facebook. Well, what is saving the environment about that? It's utter, you know what?
Not to mention the corporate governance angle of Facebook as well.
That's right.
So how to combat it? There's a couple ways to go at it. The first one is what we're doing right here in Texas. We just had a huge headline where our permanent school fund just divested $8.5 billion from BlackRock. Now that might be a drop in the bucket to a group that manages $120 billion worth of money, but still
$7 trillion. But who's counting?
What number did I read?
It's all different because it includes their passive funds and active.
Okay. Anyway, drop in the bucket compared to what they have, but $8.5 billion sounds like a lot of money to guys like me, and it sounds very significant to folks in Texas, and I think it was significant. What can you take people through kind of what that process was and is, and do you think that that's an effective way to combat?
I do think it's effective. I want to be clear though, what they did is not ESG in reverse. In other words, ESG says we are not going to buy you if you do oil and gas, and then I do not want the Texas pension fund to say we're only going to buy you if you do oil and gas. I want them to say, hey, if it's a good investment, we're going to buy you. And that might be buying oil and gas, it might not be buying oil and gas. Sometimes it's going to be some companies we like and dislike, but it's driven by a fiduciary standard. One of my problems right now on the ESG front is a ton of the anti-ESG people are basically trying to adopt their playbook. And let's go create, there's an ESG fund that has all the solar and wind and other nonsense, and we're going to go build a fund that has all this firearms and other stuff that is more on our side of political aisle. And maybe it's a good investment, maybe it's not, but the point is, gosh darn it, we're conservative. And we're doing, we need to be consistently around a fiduciary standard. And what I've chosen to do, this is my methodology, and I've been on panels of different organizations about this. There are different ways people on the right feel about it, but I'm adamant that to me, the most effective is with authentic shareholder engagement. So I don't want to be an activist. I don't want to go buy a company I don't believe in so I can go fight with their management about how to be. First of all, I don't have time. Second of all, it's dishonest. I don't really care what they're doing. I don't own it. I don't have any vested interest in it. So the companies that I'm engaging in, and I had a big issue last year with JP Morgan that I think significantly moved the needle. And I got Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan, arguably one of the best and certainly one of the most famous CEOs in America, to say, we will not debank conservatives. We will not debank Christians. We're not doing it. We're not going to do it. If it happens, I'm going to fire them. And I firmly believe them.
Yeah.
But it became a front page story in the Wall Street Journal. But I had owned JP Morgan since 2009. We'd owned over $100 million of the stock at my firm. And I had every right to make a shareholder resolution and have this conversation with them. Now, the proposal gets voted down. It gets a big public profile. We move on, and hopefully we did a little good there. But I can't do that just as an activist. I had to do it as an authentic shareholder. That's what I believe in.
And that's what I was going to kind of get to, is to the average person, what can they do? I mean, can an average person probably doesn't hold $100 million worth of shares in most companies.
Well, 50 million then. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just a couple million. But what can the average, I mean, how does this really matter to the average person? Or can they get involved in a way that is meaningful if they're not major investors?
Yeah, but the thing is that a person cannot probably move the needle on multi-billion dollar companies, and they might own $10,000 of it, whatnot, but they don't need to. I mean, there's different time and treasure resources we all have. I believe in the doctrine of subsidiarity. You have an impact of the things that are closest to you, most proximate. And not every small investor in Nebraska needs to go to war with Park Avenue. It's just not a battle that's necessarily suited for it. But what the state of Texas did was outstanding on behalf of teachers and firemen and police officers who were losing the investment returns from viable and necessary investments. Mm-hmm. They made a statement. I still believe that we need to be pro capital markets, pro Wall Street. Advocacy for people on the right of private equity is why they didn't kill oil and gas. Mm-hmm. I want everyone to think about that next time they hear. I won't say any names on the podcast, not because I don't want to get me in trouble.
Oh, come on.
You guys in trouble. But when you hear people on the new right talk about how evil private equity is, mm-hmm. the only reason you have an oil and gas industry in this country is because of private equity, because mm-hmm. they would have killed it. If they were only going after public equity and oil and gas required public equity to finance their activities, you would not have had the capital to move through the fracking revolution. It was $1 trillion of private equity and private credit that got us through that at massive returns, massively positive results. You need robust capital markets to be able to fight off the bad guys. So that's what people can do, fight for capital markets.
So thank you for saying, thank you for complimenting Texas and saying, you know, that this what the state of Texas did was excellent. So yes. Jefferson, we're going to clip that and put that into the next promo.
I mean it.
And send that out to everybody. Well, awesome. We're kind of at the end of our time. So we really, really appreciate you coming and doing these events and then letting us drag you onto the podcast and talking about all the things, including your wonderful book. And definitely for our folks out there, please go and subscribe to the podcast. It's fantastic. So thank you so much for being with us here today,
David. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. And as we always like to say, you know, let me get to that in a second. Definitely check us out online, texaspolicy.com. We've got other events that are coming up that you'll be able to watch. And then, of course, our various podcasts and our various newsletters. We'd love to have you be a subscriber to all those things. And as we like to say, now comes the end of the show. In the words of Sam Houston, do good and risk the consequences. We'll see you next time.